everyone. This is Molly Douthat.
And David Douthat.
Welcome to More Than Hearing, a podcast to encourage preachers to use multiple intelligences in sermons and worship leadership, because there are plenty of ways to reach someone's soul.
Today, we're covering Self-Smart and People-Smart for the lectionary selections for the sixth Sunday of Ordinary Time, Year C. Jeremiah, the psalmist, and Jesus in Luke all provide stark warnings about where a heart void of God's leading will take us. Spoiler, it's not good. Paul reminds the Corinthians that God's promise of resurrection in Jesus is real. We promise real cool multiple intelligence illustrations and special effects. Join us.
This podcast is based on Dr. Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences. Dr. Gardner suggests that there are multiple ways to learn, process, remember, and understand our world. Each week, centered on the weekly readings of the Revised Common Lectionary, we develop illustrations and special effects using various smarts based on Dr. Gardner's identified intelligences. Over the course of 4 weeks, we will cover word smart, eye smart, math smart, body smart, music smart, nature smart, people smart, and self smart. You could read more about Dr. Gardner's work by clicking at the link at the top of our webpage, morethanhearing.org.
Join us as we explore ways these intelligences can be utilized for a deeper appreciation of God's Word. Then we encourage you to try it yourself. Anytime and any way we can make use of the different smarts, we give people greater access to the Word of God so they can acquire it, process it, and internalize it in ways that make sense to them. Let's get started.
Well, welcome back, everyone. As with last week, this week we do not have a previous show from 3 years ago to fall back on, because we didn't do this 3 years ago.
We were into Lent already.
Yes, we were, which is kind of astonishing because it's the third week of February that we're looking at now.
Yeah.
Lent is...
It's so early then.
It's late this year. Yeah. So we are going to be doing fresh and unique stuff for this particular passage. Of course, these two particular passages are only going to be explored with two of the intelligences as opposed to all of them.
Four passages, sir.
Yes. I will be looking at them through self-smart lenses, and David will be looking at them through people-smart lenses. But to remind you, self-smart intelligence, and I am working from some information from Diana Waring and from Howard Gardner, is that self-smart people understand their own interests and goals. They're very in tune with their inner feelings. They have wisdom, intuition, and motivation, as well as a strong will, confidence, and opinions. I always think of Sheldon Cooper when I think of this one. He's a very self-smart individual.
Oh, you think?
Well, he definitely has strong opinions and inner goals and motivations. Yes, definitely. Self-smart people enjoy being alone, working independently, and rely on self-motivation. This person really needs solitary time in order to think. They're self-aware, they understand their own strengths, and they are likely to be a pioneer, an entrepreneur, or a risk-taker. I suspect they may actually be some natural leaders, but are likely indifferent as to whether anyone will follow them or not. So, as far as finding them in the church, they are very likely preachers and educators.
Well, maybe so.
Yeah, very definitely spend a lot of time in their heads and then share things with people.
Okay.
That's my opinion. I don't know. You don't seem to be agreeing with me on that.
Well, it's not a question I had thought of lately, so I don't disagree. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so what about people?
Well, people smart, and I'm also working from, actually, I'm just straight up cribbing from Diana Waring's website, dianawaring.com, which is about relational education. And I'm looking at people smart, which is more formally interpersonal intelligence as opposed to intrapersonal, which is self-smart, Molly just talked about. Interpersonal intelligence or people smart folks are good with people, whether as a leader, an organizer, a counselor, or an encourager, which is also kind of what preachers and educators mm-hmm. would be. This is the ability to understand and enjoy people. A person who is interpersonal learns best when other people are involved, whether through games, teamwork, or cooperative learning sessions. This person needs people.
That would be more of a pastor. Maybe a self-smart person in the church is more of a theologian.
It could go either way, I suppose. Yeah. You could do either. But certainly with people smart, you understand or have a kind of an innate sense of people's motivations mm-hmm. and how to motivate them.
Those would be Sunday school teachers and youth group leaders.
If they're good.
Yeah, if they're good, right. Yeah. Or people who have a heart for that kind of thing, who want to be with the children or the youth and know how to get them to interact and connect.
I was actually just reading a paper from Howard Gardner where he uses as an illustration for PeopleSmart Ann Sullivan working with Helen Keller.
Oh.
Helen Keller, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
So, and that paper is available on Gardner's website. So we'll try and put a link in there maybe.
Cool. All right. Well, let's go to the texts then. We're going to start again with the gospel for this particular Sunday, year C, Ordinary 6, Epiphany 6. The gospel lesson is Luke 6, verses 17 through 26. Boy, 6 just keeps popping up,
lots
doesn't
of sixes
it?
Today.
This is the story of the, it's the Sermon on the Plain, which is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount, the series of blessings. And Luke adds some woes to counter the blessings, which is an interesting take on it. Mm-hmm. I suppose there have probably been papers and books written about the difference between the two. It'd mm-hmm. be interesting to compare that, but we're not doing that now. That would be a word smart exercise. So we have Jesus coming, or a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon came to him, where he stood at a level place. They came to hear him and to be healed of diseases. Those troubled with unclean spirits were cured. So there's a great deal of teaching and healing that happens right before this. Then he looks up at his disciples and says, Blessed are you. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great in heaven. And then does the woes that kind of connect sort of almost a counter to each of the blessings. But again, that's word smart thing to do. So for self-smart, I was reading one of my favorite lectionary blogs, Left Behind and Loving It, written by Mark Davis, who is a Presbyterian pastor, I think. Yes. Anyway, and he does a weekly examination of the Greek in the gospel lection. And the word Makarios, which is blessed, that is used here in Greek. He says it's much more than contentment. It's an interior joy that becomes external. Elation translated into shouts, songs, and acclamations. And then he goes on to quote a scholar named Casey Hansen, who argues that the Hebrew ashare and the Greek makarios don't refer to ritual blessings as if they confer anything as a pronouncement that charm or curse someone, but instead are more like value judgments. You are blessed mm-hmm. or not, and you determine whether or not that's a blessing or a curse. So I'm going to leap over to special effect because I have a special effect directly related to that. So using Hansen's argument that a blessing is a value judgment, let's do a Marie Kondo exercise here. So as you enter a room...
So Marie Kondo, for those who aren't aware...
is the joyful decluttering or something. She's the decluttering expert. She's one that says, sit with something. If it gives you joy, hang on to it. If it doesn't, throw it out.
The joy of tidying up.
Yes, I think something like that. Yeah, and Mindy Kaling did a great take on that one. I sat with the things in her life that gave her joy, and she threw out vegetables in her electric bill. So, anyway, as you enter a room in your house, work, school, church, whatever, look at the objects in the room and decide if it gives you joy. If it does, label it blessed. You could even literally label things with a post-it note. Which things gives you such internal joy, you would be inspired to write a song about it. So that's the idea of this value judgment of things being blessed or cursed here in Luke's passage. Okay, going back to illustrations, the one thing that caught my attention right off the bat was verse 17, that Jesus came down and stood on the level place, which makes me think about how adults speak with children. They kneel or they squat down to talk with a child. They lower themselves to the child's line of sight. As the child in this particular exchange, this makes you feel noticed and taken seriously. And if you are the adult in this situation, you notice and take seriously someone who is literally smaller than you. There's something about being on the same horizontal plane that makes the communication work and make it special. So there's some, the reason
there's
I chose
some
this.
Incarnational theology there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason I chose this, or this caught me for Self-Smart, is as a kid, when adults would notice you and take you seriously, that gave you a sense of value and a sense of importance. Mm-hmm. And as an adult, seeing a child and taking that child seriously, you are giving to them a sense of value and importance. So it's a people smart thing as well, but there's a self-smart in the sense for the child of how it makes you feel, and as the adult in knowing that this is important. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you have a story that you wanted to share about a time when an adult took you seriously that way, that would work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then for another illustration, in verse 22, where Jesus says, "Blessed are you when people defame you," going directly to Mark Davis and his blog, Left Behind and Loving It, he translates the Greek there as, "Throw out your name as evil."
Mm.
So this sounds a lot more nefarious than simply calling you names or libeling you or slandering you. It suggests that you are being implicated as evil. So Jesus himself was accused of trafficking with the devil, and this may be what he might have been thinking about as he was saying this. You know, because of me, you're going to be accused of really awful things.
Mm.
So be blessed by that. Consider yourself blessed by it. And for another special effect, the word woe that we translate in in Greek is translated as woe in English. It's an interjection. Interjections show excitement or emotion. And I actually have a link to that. So you can go see that Schoolhouse Rock video about interjections. In English, interjections are words inserted in communication that convey emotions. So as you read verses 25 and 26, add some oomph to the word and you might actually even wail it. Whoa, are you? And see how that changes the emotional load.
I'm imagining the kind of interjections that I hear in non-church conversations.
Like what?
No. Things that we can't say in the podcast.
Oh.
So.
All right. So what have you got for People Smart?
So for People Smart, I was looking at verses 18 and 19 in particular, which was about healing the many, many, many people in the crowds, mm-hmm. and the people were coming and just pouring out to come be with Jesus because power was pouring out from him heal.
Right.
And I got to thinking about some of the ads and such that I've seen for like Doctors Without Borders or Operation Smile.
Mm-hmm.
These are medical organizations that go particularly into third world developing countries where there isn't a lot of healthcare or where there have been...
Or healthcare is really remote.
Right. Or there are there's been some sort of humanitarian crisis.
Or outbreaks.
Refugee
or
camps and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And they go in and they do medical care for these folks. Doctors Without Borders do all kinds of health care, including mental health care, and for free for these folks. Mm-hmm. And Operation Smile is a group that does surgeries to correct cleft lip, cleft palate. It's especially a problem in developing nations because it's related to
maternal
malnutrition.
Yeah, maternal care.
Right. So those and other such organizations often draw really big crowds when they show up. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was thinking of there. And so the compassion that's shown and the work that those, because all those medicos are
volunteer,
they're doing it gratis. And, so remarkable work, but it's no wonder you get a big crowd when when you're handing out the healthcare that way. Mm-hmm. So then for special effect, looking at the second half, the blessings and woes, show pictures, and this is a little iSmart because pictures, but show pictures of the different kinds of people in the different categories that Jesus is mentioning, so that we can get an image here. And be sure to use all sorts of ethnicities in both the blessings and the woes. Mm-hmm. We have a tendency to stereotype. Yeah, to stereotype who are the poor, who are the hungry, right? But
who are the rich?
Yeah. And, the reality is that all ethnicities and all walks of life have all of these people, right? So let's help people get used to that idea rather than saying, oh, those folks are always poor, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's a little bit iSmart, but the pictures of people get people thinking about people.
People who need people.
Yeah. So, and then also their relationships with them. So, there's an opportunity here to plug into some self-smart as people reflect on where they connect with those pictures too. Mm-hmm. Then, pressing on, invite your folks to discuss the pictures with each other in couples or small groups in your congregation, either right there or maybe after the service, have it set up that people can talk about, but right then might be good. With questions like which picture was most moving, or with which did you most closely associate, and which was the most uplifting and which most upsetting. Okay, let's go on. The New Testament lesson for Year C, Ordinary 6, is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 12 through 20. This picks up right where we left off in Corinthians last time, as Paul continues to explore the resurrection with the Corinthians, because they seem to have got it a little confused. And here, especially, somebody is apparently claiming that there ain't no such thing as resurrection, or at least not for them. So Paul makes the case that if there isn't a resurrection from the dead, then Christ isn't raised. If Christ isn't raised, then you are then still in your sin, and our proclamation is vain. We're misrepresenting God because we said God raised Christ from the dead, which didn't happen if there's no resurrection. Mm-hmm. And if all of that is so, and there isn't any of that, then the people that you love that died in Christ are lost. And we are most to be pitied because we are pinning our hopes on that, on the resurrection. And so the truth is that Christ has been raised as the first fruits from the dead. So, I think Paul's struggling to understand the Corinthians' motivation in claiming there's no resurrection, especially since it's what has come to define their existence as Christians and as a church. And that's to say nothing of what it means to him personally and his ministry. Mm-hmm. You know, it has entirely redefined who he is. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to figure out what are you doing there? What's behind all of this? So for illustration, consider the confusion that you might have if someone made claims like food has no nutritional value. There's no good reason to eat. Or, there's no such thing as air. I can't see it. I don't believe in it. Right? Or love is just an artificial construct perpetuated by the government to control the masses.
Well, no, people do say those sorts of things. There is this week there was a report of a particular news organization who had a reporter on air confess to the fact that he's not washed his hands in the last 10 years because he can't see germs, therefore he doesn't believe in them. We're not really sure if he's joking or not.
Yeah.
It's possible he means it.
Well, yeah, we try not to cast aspersions here too much, but yeah, that guy deserves some aspersions. Anyway, in all of these cases, like Paul, you might think, wait, that makes no sense. I mean, what would make you say such a thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking it's not too different from flat earthers and anti-vaxxers, if you want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple links to some memes about flat earthers and anti-vaxxers and some internet conversations around them, if you want to venture into those waters. Then for special effect, push it a little further and invite your folks to try out one or more of these lines with their friends or coworkers this coming week, just to see what kind of reaction they get, you know, and hopefully people will be shocked.
But, you know, and hopefully you won't be shocked when they say, I know, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about food has no nutritional value, I saw something actually for something I'm doing further down about a person who was a breatharian.
What? What's that?
I think that was the word. She believed that she could get all of her nourishment from sunlight, and she died after fasting for 21 days.
Yeah.
Because she died.
Didn't drink anything either. Oh my goodness! Wow.
So food has no
nutritional value. So she thought she was a plant.
I guess.
Jeez, Louise.
So you know.
That's amazing.
It's really kind of scary because these sorts of things might not generate any shock at all in our current culture. God help us.
Indeed.
Anyway. Send your folks out to see
what
kind of reaction they might get. And if they do get a shocked reaction, then they can come clean and say, no, this was just an exercise.
A thought experiment, yeah.
An experiment our preacher was talking about. And use this then as a way of getting into the text about the resurrection with your coworkers or your friends. You know, our pastor was talking about this passage where the Corinthians make what Paul thinks is a ridiculous claim. Mm-hmm. And then he talks to them about the logic behind their views on the resurrection. It's like this. And, you know, it opens the door for a conversation then with your friends or coworkers about your faith and the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's people smart because you're engaging with other people.
And there may be some self-smart exercises prior to doing that because you're going to have to figure out what you believe about the resurrection and how it informs your life, particularly as a disciple, and how you would talk about that to somebody who either has never heard of it or has heard of it and thinks it's a bosh.
Yeah. So as preacher, you might want to give folks some ammunition there or enough to work with and some direction so that they have an idea how that conversation might proceed a little bit. And, you know, you can take take all the heat for it. You know, if they're if they're willing to do it, you know, say, yeah, my tell people my preacher said this.
Yeah.
You know, and then let them react to the preacher and right, not to right. them. So right. in that way, it makes it a little safer, maybe.
Well, for self-smart, what Paul is trying to instill in the Corinthians is hope of the resurrection. Hope is in Jesus' resurrection, that it happened and it will happen for us. Hope has behavioral consequences. If you hope for something, you're going to live in such a way that that hope informs you. You're going to act in a way that hope is real. So I have a quote here from The Power of Hope and Recognizing When It's Hopeless from Psychology Today in 2011. The author says that hope is better understood as a cognition that creates a certain mood, a prolonged affective state, lacking the immediacy and intensity of reflexive emotions, yet capable of determining one's outlook on life. It's a way of thinking that guides your actions. An illustration of that is a placebo. A placebo is a good example of a hopeful outcome, and some studies have showed that the stronger the expectation that the, quote, drug will have an effect, the more likely the, quote, effect will happen. The relationship between the patient and the caregiver also plays a part. I'm thinking of this in terms of self-smart, in that somebody who hopes and somebody who is holding very strongly, very firmly to that hope, understands that this hope is not something that is present right now. It's something that's coming in the future. It's sort of like holding on to the tail of a kite. The kite is out there somewhere, but you have hold of it. I also found a TED talk called The Power of Positive Thinking. It's a talk about reframing gains and losses. The person who introduces this TED talk is a sociological researcher, and she talks about the high that she gets when a paper is accepted and published, and she shows this baseline of herself moving along at life, and then this wonderful thing happens. She's like, "Yay!" And then she's back down to baseline, but then. A paper is rejected and she, boom, bottoms out. And it takes a lot longer for her to get back to baseline of normal. Mm-hmm. And she wondered mm-hmm. to herself, why is it that those highs happen but only last so long, and why a bottoming out can take so long to come back from? So she talks about it in terms of losses and gains and how we pay attention to the loss frame of reference. And so the question is it more difficult to move from loss to gain? And the way that she illustrates this is how long it takes to do a simple math problem. So for somebody who's kind of at baseline or above baseline doing a simple math problem, like a simple algebraic formula, finding X really easily, it's you know, if you know how to do it, boom, you're there. But if you've bottomed out, and that's sucking all the oxygen out of the room, that this loss, then it takes you longer to be able to do a simple math problem.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I know that from playing Sudoku. if things are going fine, you know, I can do it pretty quickly. If I've got something on my mind, my time will be 50% longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Just looking at the thing like, I don't understand what's going on here.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, you're not putting as much
energy
into the solution.
Yeah, because all the energy is cycling around that loss or that thing that's bugging you. Yeah. Right, right. So for a special effect, this idea of the power of positive thinking, this TED Talk, writing and rehearsing good news will probably help you do the work of reframing your mindset. We tend to talk about the annoying and the negative, which we then pay attention to and just spiral down with. So for this next coming week, spend the week making positive inventory of your life, especially as you see God on the move in your life. So take a week, maybe two, maybe more, depending on how much energy you're devoting to the negative in life. take some time and look specifically for the positive and do that for a while and then see how that happens and encourage your congregation to give it a try too. All right, let's go on. The psalm is Psalm 1, going all the way back to the very beginning. It sets the tone. This particular psalm sets the tone for the ancient book of worship. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked or take the path that sinners tread or sit in the seat of scoffers, but delight in the law of the Lord. And then the next four verses go on to compare those two people, the wicked and the ways they get dried up and blown away by the wind, which is an awesome nature smart illustration. Yeah. And those who delight in the law of the Lord are like trees planted by streams of water, yielding their fruit in its season, and their leaves do not wither. So again, some really good nature smart there, which it gets repeated in Jeremiah. Spoiler! For self-smart, I have to admit, I was really, horribly distracted by the nature smart in this, which I did last week. But this one, I was like, and then I thought, oh, scoffers. So I went up and I looked up the word because I'm a word nerd. And the Cambridge Dictionary defines scorn, which is another way you can translate the Hebrew word, scoffer. Scorn is a strong feeling that someone or something is of little or no worth and deserves no respect. Scoffing is a little different from scorn. Scoffing is more just kind of dismissing. Scorn is actively
disrespecting.
It's much more intentional, and there seems to be much more of an emotional load with it. So one thing led to another, and I wound up at a website called Open Democracy, and read a paper by a woman named Nina Eliasoff, I think I'm saying her name right, who is a sociology professor at USC. She wrote an article called Scorn Wars, Rural White People and Us, and she wrote it about the time of the general election here in the United States back in 2016. She examines attitudes and assumptions that have divided some of the U.S. population, and this is a quote from her article. Feeling invisible and scorned, they, that is rural white people, want to turn the tables to convince each other that the first shall be last and that they are the real folk, humble, hardworking, and full of gratitude, while we, coastal elites, are self-important, ungrateful, lazy complainers. So there's a great deal of scorn that seems to be at the heart of some of the attitudes that us and them have been participating in our country.
Yeah, does it go the opposite direction?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Does she say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot has been written. A lot of ink has been spilled about this divide here in the United States, and I think it's probably not unique to us. I think it's happening around the world, and it's essentially as a haves and have nots, or us them, those guys us guys, a dichotomy. And I'm putting it here in self-smart because of the idea of scorn and how scorn can take root in an attitude or a stereotype or a presumption about the other, and how scorn is something that it seems kind of reflexive, particularly if you have a lot of resentment and a lot of bitterness. So scorn is just kind of a cousin to those things. Eliasoff goes on in her article to reject stereotypical thinking and learn to speak to the other, which is coming around more and more in conversations of the divide here in the United States, of learning how to look at the other, speak to the other. And a lot of people that are saying this are faith leaders, folks who are, some of them who have to walk that fine line between us and them in their own congregations. How do you keep your congregation speaking to each other and not divide into warring camps? So the author of the Psalms urges us to look first to God, which grounds us in an eternal perspective of humanity and creation. So here's a self-smart exercise. If you're having difficulty with scornful feelings about the other, go to God and read scripture, read the Psalms, read places where the other is mentioned. See how God deals with the other. Ground yourself in opportunities for prayer and Bible study, seeing how God sees the other, and then see if that changes your perspective. Hopefully it should.
Yeah.
I mean, if nothing else, you come to an understanding that God loves those people. And so maybe that will begin changing attitudes in your own heart, particularly if you're finding yourself living in times of scorn. So for a special effect, I'm looking at verses 3 and 4, that nature smart thing. So bring in two different plants, one that's healthy and well-rooted in a pot, another that's dried up and is barely hanging on, and I am a pro with that type of plant. So exhibit them prominently as you speak about being rooted in God's love and word, which nourishes us. And if you have someone who knows a thing or two about plants, ask them what be done to aid the suffering plant if it isn't too late. And then encourage your folks as they think about feelings of scorn for the other or how they find themselves in connection to God. Which of those two plants are they? Mm-hmm. It's sort of a visual reminder and a way to connect themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it's using the nature smart illustration to lead into the self-smart
examination.
Reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Good. Well, for people smart, I also was thinking about sinners and scoffers from verse 1 and came up with some
Darwin Awards
stories about people who, whose path you do not want to follow. And this is where the breatharian came from, actually. So
okay.
I've got several links for you to stories of sinners, scoffers, and otherwise unwise people who died as a result of their poor choices. You can find them at the Darwin Awards, for example. The Darwin Awards are celebrating those folks who are cleansing the genetic pool
By removing themselves from it
through their own stupidity or poor choices. And if you're not familiar with the Darwin Awards, it's worth a look. So a couple of the links are specifically Darwin Awards, and the other is just some folks that are probably nominees, I think. Not all of these folks are necessarily wicked, as the psalm points to, but they didn't stand in the judgment, as it were. So, you know, there it is. In particular, there was one guy who cut off his own head with a chainsaw.
Jeez, what the heck?
To impress his friends. So,
yeah, I'm sure he did.
I'm sure that impressed them.
Not
the way that he thought. So don't follow their advice and don't walk in their paths. It's people smart for understanding motivations and influence.
Oh, man.
For special effect, invite your folks to discuss in small groups a time when someone gave them bad advice. And did they take it or leave it? And did they know it was bad at the time? And if so, how did they know? And that would be people smart for relational sharing with others and listening to others' experiences and thought processes. So let's go on. The Old Testament lesson for Year C, Ordinary 6, is Jeremiah 17, verses 5 through 10, also known as Psalm 1.
Yeah, pretty much.
It is in many ways indistinguishable. So it starts off, "Cursed are those who trust in mere mortals and make mere flesh their strength, who turn away from the Lord. They're like shrubs in the desert, in parched places in the wilderness."
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. "Blessed are those who trust in the Lord. They will be like trees planted next to the water with roots by the stream, and they will not fear when heat or drought comes, and they will not cease to bear fruit. Then a little change from the psalm. The heart is devious above all else. It is perverse. Who can understand it? Well, the Lord can.
Thank God.
Indeed. So the Lord will test the mind and heart and give to all according to their ways and doings. So, yeah.
So we see why the psalm and Jeremiah are matched up with Luke.
Yes. Yes. It's all very much the same. So, for illustration, then, the passage is, I got to thinking about it, and this took a while, but I finally came around to this, that the passage is like a commercial. Mm-hmm. It's like a comparison commercial.
Okay.
Their product, not the Lord, is terrible and leaves you tired and frustrated. Our product, the Lord, leaves you feeling refreshed and ready for action.
Like those MyPillow.
Like all the as seen on TV type commercials. So I've got a link for one for the Perfect Slicer, which is a thing that cuts fruit.
A perfect slicer.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. It cuts all your fruits into 12 sections and cores it, whether it needs to be cored or not. They were coring watermelons for some reason, but, you know, whatever. Perfectly sliced, though. So I've got another commercial then about people who put their trust in the wrong place. It's a beer commercial.
Oh, boy. You can just stop right there.
So there's that. Apparently, our culture is not alone in being short-sighted. It matches up with the text in that regard. And then another one that features a character or some characters who prefer slow internet connection to fast internet connection.
Sure.
The point
there's
being,
no error.
The point, right. Yeah. The point being that they're putting their trust in the wrong thing. See, that slow thing over there.
Yeah. Right. That actually does fit with the Corinthians passage.
Well, you know, it kind of does. There's a certain subset of commercials where the foil character won't give up on the old busted thing.
Right, right.
Right. And that's the thing that I was looking for, but I couldn't find it. So I ended up just going with the as seen on TV things where the bad old busted thing shows up in black and white. Yeah. So.
Which is how you know it's bad.
Right, exactly. So here's the special effect for all of that. And you could actually tie all four texts into this, I think. Mm-hmm. But perform the text like one of those cheesy commercials. If you have the time and the talent, actually go ahead and film the commercial for display so that you can use special effects and put in the black and white for the old and busted.
That's but great.
It'd be like, does trusting in mere mortals leave you feeling cursed? Then turn your heart to the Lord. The strength of mere flesh can leave you feeling like a shrub in the desert, parched and dry. Ouch! But when you trust in the Lord, you'll be like a tree planted by water. No need to worry about drought or heat there. And just look at all that tasty, healthy fruit. Hearts can be devious and downright sick, but the soul that trusts in the Lord will stand in the judgment and the congregation of the righteous. So act now. Operators are standing by. So certainly some Psalm 1, certainly the Beatitudes and even the Corinthians. You could bring all of those things in there.
Absolutely.
So
that's fun.
All of this is people smart because of the motivational aspects of advertising. Mm-hmm. And the special effect is people smart also for drama because that helps you identify with other people and characters. Mm-hmm. So, how about self-smart?
Well, self-smart, I got verses 9 and 10 are what grabbed my attention. Verse 9, the Hebrew word is translated as devious or deceitful in the New Revised Standard Version. But I went looking for it at Bible Hub, which is a really good resource for the original language of Hebrew and Greek. And the word can also be translated as tracked by footprints. Which I thought was very evocative.
Indeed.
So the question is, whose footprints are on your heart and in what condition have they left it? Might be an interesting way to enter into a self-smart examination of a deceitful or devious heart. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 10, as David has already mentioned, it's a prophetic response to the rhetorical question. Who can understand it? Well, God can. So Jeremiah leaves us with a deep question. What is your heart condition? And then gives us hope that the results are not terminal. Also, that the physician, the psychiatrist, the psychologist who will be attending is God.
Hmm.
So there are some self-smart ways of looking at the devious heart, the tracked heart. Why is your heart in the condition it's in?
So maybe you could also do an exploration of people's responses to their doctors and their cardiologists,
right,
if they have them. And if you're Presbyterian, lots of your people have cardiologists by now.
And you've been to one yourself.
They may have. That patient-doctor relationship may be a self-smart reflection you could do.
Well, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Also, Bobby Morris at Working Preacher, talking about the idea that, sometimes our heart conditions in the existential sense of the word kind of leave us in this really dark place. And he says about this passage, to the contrary, as a closer look at this pericope will reveal, Jeremiah provides an indispensable witness to the complex reality, difficulty, and often misguidedness of the human experience, as well as to a God who enters undeterred into and faces all the complexity and messiness thereof. So God knows the condition of our heart and who left the footprints on it, and doesn't leave us sitting there by ourselves with it.
Mm-hmm.
So for a
more incarnational theology.
Yeah, there you go.
Too, right?
Exactly. For a special effect, we're just about to go into Valentine's Day here, so go to the store and get hearts. You can either get those little candy hearts or sticker hearts, depending on what you can find. And hand them out to
everybody.
Right. And hand them out to everybody and ask them to consider the existential condition of their hearts. Identify the footprints on them and decide how you and God are going to deal with your condition.
Mm.
And the withered plant from the psalm would also work here, too.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
That's it for today's podcast. Please ask questions or leave us a comment on our website, www.morethanhearing.org, or at facebook.com/morethanhearing, or tweet us at morethanhearing, or email us at connect@morethanhearing.org. If you tried any of these suggestions, or maybe got an idea that you like even better than ours, please let us know what you did and how it went. We would love to hear how using this theory has made a difference in your preaching and worship.
Remember to check out the show notes, worksheets, links, and resources at our website. They go hand in glove with the podcast and give you lots more material to work with. Don't forget to subscribe using the links on the website for iTunes, Google Play, Android, or good old RSS, or point your podcatching software at morethanhearing.org/feed/podcast. Help others find us more easily by writing a review at the iTunes store, and of course, you can always share the show with your friends and colleagues. We'll be back with another episode next week, so in the meantime, stay subscribed
and be smart.
The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
This is a Whippet Good production.